You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 4th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Suzanne Schneider, Deputy Director and Core Faculty at the Brooklyn Institute, author of The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad, and the Crisis of Liberalism. Also on the program today, Chuck Schumer will hold a vote on filibuster reform for voting rights. New York AG Letitia James subpoenas Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. over Trump Inc.'s fraud case. More cities pause in-person schooling as a COVID tsunami hits. The new mayor of New York, Eric Adams, is... he says it's over. Meanwhile, over 1 million new infections yesterday. Fortunately, some mounting evidence that Omicron somewhat milder and that the vaccines are working, at least in saving lives. George W. Bush appointed federal judge blocks the Department of Defense COVID vaccine mandate. Because apparently there's some religion out there that is against specific vaccines. Elizabeth Holmes found guilty in four counts in the Theranos fraud. January 6th commission moving into high gear. And of course, Trump endorses Viktor Orban in the Hungarian elections coming up in spring. Those nurses in Worcester, they signed their contract ending a 10-month strike, the longest for nurses in Massachusetts history. And New York State looks like it's on track to quash some Republican seats in Congress. All that and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma is still on vacation. She will be out for the rest of the week. I still have my my beard and my vacation glasses. We may play out the week that way. I'm not sure. The beard gets a little itchy sometimes, but supposedly you grow through that stage.
People are really engaged with it.
People seem to be very, it's very polarizing. It's very polarizing, the beard. But I will say this. I feel like it might be warmer. It's been very cold the past 2 days walking down to work. And I feel like the beard is helping with that on the face. I'm starting to understand the sort of material benefits of the beard. So we'll see. We'll see. I don't know. We'll of course, dedicate an entire show to that in the coming days, I'm sure. Meanwhile... Build Back Better is still in some form of, I don't know, arrested development. I don't know. What cold storage? I don't know what you call it.
Life support, cryogenics.
Exactly. Chuck Schumer is, however, is turning up the pressure on voting rights. He apparently, according to a dear colleague letter, he will hold a vote on some type of filibuster reform specifically in regards to voting rights. Here he is with Joy Reid explaining.
have the two conservative Democrats who've been standing in the way of changing the filibuster signed on to anything that looks like either of those two options?
We are having active discussions with them several a day. I just spoke to Senator Manchin 3 or 4 hours ago. And even over the holiday break, the New Year's and Christmas break, we've been talking constantly, not just me, but just about every one of the 48 Democratic senators who supports not only the proposal, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Restore the Voting Rights Act, but changing the rules. There are a variety of different rules changes, some of which you've mentioned, some of which you haven't, which we're exploring with them, which we're pushing with them. And whichever one works to get us to have voting rights kept, to undo the pernicious activities of the Republican legislatures, we will accept. And we're having constant discussions. And we've said to them, you, both Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, say they believe in voting rights. Good. That's great. And they are sponsors of the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Act. But just to believe in it and not change the rules. And we're making it clear to them, Joy, that even a paragon who believed in the Senate rules, Robert C. Byrd, changed the rules 9 times.
I mean, that's a message specifically from Manchin. It seems very hard to believe that Kyrsten Sinema at this point, too. And there's a real sense that Sinema realizes she may have made a grave, grave miscalculation, thinking that she could do some type of mirror version of John McCain. Because the polling is out, and she's in big, big trouble in the Democratic Party. And it is, and I imagine she got out a little ahead of her skis, in front of her skis, before she saw how Mark Kelly is going to do in 2024. Because it looks like Mark Kelly, 2022, Mark Kelly is up for re-election. He might do a little better than she anticipated. So the real issue here is Manchin, and that is why Schumer talks about Byrd, because supposedly, in the narrative that Manchin at least wants to be put out there, that his fealty to the filibuster is a function of Robert Byrd. And so the argument will be made in that way, and this is going to be, this is part of Joe Manchin's reformation project, it seems to me. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do see some version of filibuster reform narrowly tailored to some type of voting rights bill. But we'll see. We'll have a better sense of this in the coming weeks. As far as Build Back Better, of course, once Joe Manchin, if he does go along with the idea of cutting back on the filibuster in some way, he basically owns Build Back Better and will be able to do whatever he wants, which, of course, sounds like immiserate people who have been benefiting from the child tax credit. We have an insane system in this country, and some of that actually pertains to what our guest, Suzanne Schneider, will be talking about and what she writes about in The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism, which we will get to in a moment. First, a couple of words from our sponsors. If you got a small business, you know that there's nothing more valuable than your time. So stop wasting it by leaving your office ever, particularly when you have to go to the post office. Post office right now is, well, look, it's also the case, I noticed this when I walked to work too, like any type of package place, doesn't matter if it's the post office or, you know, one of those private entities that ship stuff, you can avoid all that with Stamps.com. It makes it easy to mail and ship right from your computer. You can send letters, and you can send packages, and you can do so for less with discounted rates not only from the U.S. Postal Service, but also UPS and more. Since 1998, Stamps.com has been indispensable for nearly 1 million businesses. Stamps.com brings the services of the U.S. Postal Service and UPS shipping right to your computer. You can print official postage for any letter, any package, to go anywhere you want to send it. Once your mail is ready, you just schedule a pickup or you drop it off. Easy peasy. Stamps.com, new rate advisor tool. You can compare shipping rates and timelines to easily find the best option. Back when we were doing, when we were sending out DVDs in the early days, I guess this was a long time ago now. I was printing out stamps.com postage like at 3 in the morning. It's the way I rolled back then. It was when I was younger. Now I do it during business hours. Makes it just much easier. And, of course, you get discounts. You can save time and you can save money with stamps.com. There's no risk. With my promo code MajorityReport, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. There's no long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, type in Majority Report. One word, Majority Report. At stamps.com, promo code Majority Report. Stamps.com, never leave your office again. Or your home, for that matter. Or your home office. Good time to stay inside. Or not, maybe not necessarily get in lines and crowds, if you know what I'm saying. Meanwhile, using the internet without ExpressVPN is basically like leaving your laptop exposed at the coffee shop table while you run to the bathroom. You would never do that. Most of the time, you're probably fine. Nobody's going to get up, move over with their coffee, start messing around. But the bottom line is, one day may come, you come out of the bathroom and your laptop, it's gone. Every time you connect with an unencrypted network, any hacker on the same network can gain access to your personal data, like passwords, financial details, etc., etc. All you got to do is they go into your web browser preferences, look up your password. It's not that hard. A smart 12-year-old, some cheap hardware could do it, and they could make up to $1,000 selling your personal info. I like to think mine might be worth a little bit more than that, but ExpressVPN creates a super secure encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet so that hackers can't steal your sensitive data. It works on all devices. It's super easy to use. You just fire up the app, you click one button, and you're protected. I don't even know why they say fire up the app. You click on the app, you click one button. That's it. It's super easy. I don't even think about it anymore. In the copy, they say, you know, tell your audience what you like most about ExpressVPN. The thing I like most about it, I don't think about it anymore. I just use it, and I don't have to worry about anything. It's just a lack of anxiety to know I have one more level of protection. That's basically, you know, why do I wear a mask when I go into a store, even when we were down and numbers were down? Because I don't want to even think about it. And then the other part I like about it is I can stream stuff from a different place, if you know what I mean. ExpressVPN hides your location. You can secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/majority. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority, and you can get an extra 3 months free. ExpressVPN.com/majority. ExpressVPN.com/majority. We will put links to that in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. And as always, it's your support that keeps this show going. If you want to support the show and get the first half ad-free, become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, a reminder, the live show not happening on January 16th. I think everybody knows this by now. We have punted to May 15th at 2 p.m. You can either exchange your tickets, or if you want a refund, you need a refund, info@wilbur.com? TheWilbur.com. info@thewilbur.com. You can check out our newsletter for more information. All right, I want to welcome to the program Sarah Schneider. She's deputy director and core faculty at the Brooklyn Institute, author of The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. I'm sorry, did I say Suzanne? It's a Suzanne. Suzanne, welcome.
Hello, nice to be on.
All right, so it's nice to have you. So I want to start with some stuff that's fairly maybe remedial, just so that we have our terms, you know, everybody's on the same page with terms. Let's just start at the end. When we say liberalism, what are we talking about?
Great question. So at least when political theorists use the term liberalism, we don't tend to just mean it as a kind of contemporary political movement associated with, say, like, you know, Hillary Clinton or something like this, but as a broader kind of project that really has roots in the 17th century, going back to figures like John Locke, that advances this argument that there's some sort of necessary relationship between democracy, freedom of the markets, and individual liberty. And that kind of holds those three things up and kind of elevates them. That goes along with, you know, private property rights, the idea that government exists in order to preserve and protect private property, that, again, the freedom of the market is mirrored by individual liberty. So it's a kind of, you know, much broader system of political thought that has its roots, you know, again, way back in the 17th century, and that is broadly shared, I would say, across the political constituency, not just by people who would call themselves liberals today.
Okay. In some respects, the phenomena that you are looking at here is a function, you would argue, of a failure of liberalism. So what was the idea behind that? Aside from we get a sense of what the structure of liberalism, what was the purpose of espousing liberalism at that time and ostensibly through the following centuries?
Well, I mean, we could elevate a few different things, but right, some sort of popular sovereignty, right? The idea it's kind of an anti-monarchical position. It's a democratic position associated that's really espoused historically by this kind of emerging like merchant bourgeois class that is interested in free trade and the kind of acquisition of wealth through sources other than just like, you know, the feudal system where wealth is tied to the land. And liberalism is a very durable political system. And we say that, you know, many people, even people further to the left, there's plenty about liberalism that we're not willing to kind of give up on or abandon, right? A commitment to individual rights and freedoms, I think, being kind of paramount among them. The question is whether that kind of essential relationship that's laid out originally in the 17th century, that's rearticulated in the 19th century and kind of dug into by a kind of class of people we call the neoliberals, right? There's this essential idea of kind of capitalism and democracy is going hand in hand, whether or not that really still works for us today in the 21st century. And I think you start to see the cracks where those things are pulling apart today. And that is one of the reasons that we kind of, you know, one of the reasons people talk about some sort of like a crisis of liberalism, because on the one hand, you see capitalism being taken up, espoused by and flourishing in places which are certainly not liberal democracies. Whether we're looking at the Gulf or whether we're looking at kind of some sort of state capitalism in China, and that, you know, these two things may actually pull in opposite directions, right? And on the other hand, you have a critique from the left that genuine democracy may require a taming of the market and subjecting the market forces to popular sovereignty in a way that would be an anathema to kind of classic liberal thinking.
Okay. And so now let's jump to work sort of backwards through your title to jihad. I mean, just the idea of a modern jihad.
Yeah.
We have this sense in this country, or we've been told by many, and you cite some of the new atheists, and we've had opportunity around here to critique some of those new atheists, that jihad is like almost like not quite eternal, but certainly has been sort of a thing that exists regardless of context from the beginning of Islam. Tell us, I guess, just what jihad, A, and then B, let's talk about that context of the idea of it. There's actually, it has a history. And as we see it today, it's different.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so there, you're pulling on a few different threads, and I'll see if I can try to kind of individually pull them out and then weave them back together. That, right, so in terms of, yes, you know, jihad, like other forms of war, has a history. And some of the mystification, I think, that's attached to that term and the exoticism that gets overlaid it, particularly in the US or the West more broadly post 9/11, kind of starts to evaporate if you think about it as a form of warfare that was historically waged by Muslim leaders and governments. And that the kind of that, you know, holy war has this association with something so much broader than just like a form of warfare that was kind of the type of war waged by Muslim rulers. But even to kind of go back a little bit further, right, jihad etymologically has a bunch of different meanings that, you know, linguists point to having to do with the kind of underlying Arabic term has to do with the concept of striving. There is definitely a, you know, possibility of having a jihad that has nothing to do with violence. There's kind of ample evidence for this within the kind of classical sources. And I acknowledge that, but I am also actually interested in the type of jihad, which really means war. And looking at the way that that has evolved over centuries, it would be very strange if a form of violence did not evolve at all. And to have that kind of ahistorical look at war, which we wouldn't kind of, we wouldn't support that in our own instances. Like we look at, right, the kind of way that warfare has changed from, say, the 17th century to the present. Like the war on terror doesn't look anything like the American Revolution. Why would jihad look like it did in the, you know, medieval period? So yes, we kind of have to get away from these constructions about jihad as an essential thing, as an ahistorical thing, as something that remains the same over kind of time and place, and which is related to a kind of a broader tendency to think about Islam as something that exists outside of time, outside of material conditions, that has some sort of fixity that we don't assign to anybody else. And kind of, so once we kind of back up from that, you know, essentialist view, we can see something really different, which is that up until roughly the beginning of the 20th century, jihad is, yes, something that's declared by a recognized ruler. So the, you know, the kind of most recent example of this is during the First World War, when the Ottoman kind of Sultan Caliph declares jihad as the Ottoman Empire enters the war. You know, you are conscripted to fight in a jihad in the way that you might be drafted to fight war. It is not like a vigilante sort of activity. But something really shifts radically in the mid-20th century as kind of a variety of kind of the post-colonial states seem to lack legitimacy in the eyes of their people, where they say, wait, wait, wait. How can these rulers be trusted upon to wage jihad? They're not even legitimate rulers. Who's going to do this? Actually, all that responsibility now is going to devolve to us as individuals. Jihad then becomes an insurrectionist tool, a revolutionary tool. So if most of its history, it's like a tool of states, it suddenly becomes a tool that's turned against states. And this is the form that we inherited today. And it's such a radical and revolutionary shift, but yet it's like completely absent from most of the kind of contemporary conversation. But if we think about it with the broader arc of, you know, of the rest of the world, of kind of the development of different forms of violence, it makes a lot of sense to say, aha, well, actually, jihad has been privatized. In much the same way that other forms of violence have been privatized. Like, this shouldn't actually be that surprising, other if we are able to abandon, again, that like essentialist view that thinks Islam is totally different and outside of the currents that are happening in the rest of the world.
Okay, so I want to go back over some of because that's a lot that's a lot for people to absorb, that dynamic. That now, was there not an era where we did not have as well defined nation states, that so that there was an era that maybe existed, and I don't know if it would have been considered jihad necessarily. And again, we're not talking about the development of the sort of the from a tactical standpoint as much as, although that's probably the case in methodological, but we're talking about the purpose of jihad and what it's supposed to achieve. But would there not have been some measure of violence that you could describe as being privatized prior to that? Or would that just simply have been a sort of more of a feudal type of system?
Well, no, I think that that's exactly right, is that the, you know, the conceit of the modern state is that it's going to subject violence to kind of public control of some form or another. And that, which is why kind of certain people, you know, talk about us in this like period of like neo-feudalism, where people have like private armies again, alongside, you know, the ways that, you know, your feudal lords may have in like the 15th century or something. right? Jihad has existed outside of the nation state, which is a really recent formation, right? But it's often existed right within the kind of empires, within kind of caliphates, or even just local rulers that are recognized as kind of having, you know, some sort of control over territory. So it's not that it's tied to the nation state so much as it's tied to a recognized political authority. That is what is different. And that it's kind of, you know, declaration is, it has to be in the hands of someone who is recognized as an imam, as a leader.
Okay. And so now we have a situation where, at least in the context of jihad, we have this sort of privatized version where it is, and in some ways it is both. Well, it's a reflection of what has happened to liberalism, right? And it's also a, in some ways, it's antithetical to liberalism, from a theoretical standpoint, insofar as it's not democratized the waging of jihad. But in many respects, your argument is that it's also very reflective of liberalism as it exists in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, it's really complicated, unfortunately, right? It even changes within the modern history of jihad. So like one of the key figures here writing in the 1950s and 1960s is an Egyptian thinker by the name of Said Qutb, who's kind of broadly viewed as the, you know, father of modern jihad ideology. And actually a lot of his critiques of kind of the existing political authorities and rulers do have a kind of democratic undertone to them. That is precisely because these leaders are corrupt and were not chosen by the people that they can be disobeyed, and that jihad devolves onto individuals because they can't be trusted with that responsibility. And the, you know, there's the real elevation here of one of liberalism's kind of key, you know, key figures, the individual, the celebration of individuals and individual responsibility, individual duty that kind of runs throughout the course of this history of modern jihad, where we can't the collective is no longer able or trusted with the kind of performing of certain duties. These things devolve onto you as an individual's and individual responsibilities. It's like radically, it's a massive revolution within Islamic law to say that this is an individual duty, in this way. So it's like, there's a strange kind of mimicry and negation of the concepts and frameworks of liberalism that you see in something like jihad. But again, you'll never see that if you just kind of, you know, take the new atheists or whomever of the world at their word for it, that this is some weird medieval phenomenon. Because once you start delving into the sources themselves, you see not just their modernity, but really like their hyper-modernity. And they start to make sense as a kind of real products of the modern world, not as a kind of product of a former one.
And I just want to plant a flag in what you've just talked about, because I feel like I read a Washington Post article about Republican opinions that sort of track with that same sort of description of this sense of government has failed and we got to take it upon ourselves. And, on some level it's don't tread on me.
Certainly.
Let's talk more about, and you're looking specifically at ISIS. Like, what makes ISIS unique in terms of a break from this tradition or the trajectory, I guess, of this tradition?
So ISIS was, often collapsed with, you know, Al-Qaeda or kind of other groups, but really it did have something unique about it, in which, Al-Qaeda is it is a billionaire playboy creation of a different sort, essentially. And it had this kind of elitist kind of vanguard quality to it. And that, you know, saw jihad as a chiefly kind of like a moral quest that, you know, Muslims were called to do on this like massive global scale. But they didn't ever think about establishing a kind of parallel political authority, right? They would say all of these, you know, various nation states are corrupt and illegitimate, but the notion of kind of, of establishing a new caliphate was pretty far from their thinking, right? So ISIS, or the Islamic State, was novel in that it attempted to really create this alternative form of political, social, religious authority by reestablishing a caliphate, which had been dissolved in 1924 by the kind of new secular government of Turkey. So this is kind of one thing that, you know, distinguishes them on the one hand. They have a, they advance a more exclusionary view of the political community, of the Muslim community, even than Al-Qaeda, which is something that's just fascinating and that we can certainly point to that corresponds in certain ways with thinking in the kind of new far right circles about who is in and who is out, who really belongs to the community. And you saw a lot of this in the kind of intercommunal or intracommunal violence, which was so marked in Syria and Iraq during the kind of heyday, attacking kind of, rival tribes that refused to submit to their authority, really attacking the kind of established clergy, executing them en masse in many instances, right? It's attacks on the Shia. This notion that there's a real community, the real ummah, but that most people don't belong to it. So there's this, pretense of universality that comes along with a very, very exclusionary vision as to who the real community is. And I find that that really fascinating about them, that on the one hand, the global vision, and on the other hand, the incredibly narrow idea as to who really belongs.
How do those two things coexist? I mean, how do those two ideas coexist?
Well, they coexist for, think of a few things. On the one hand, right, this is something that's clearly facilitated by global media. You can't have this vision of political community outside of a fully networked, system of communications, media, online platforms, et cetera. It's just simply impossible. Because on the other hand, it depends on the notion of an elect, all right? There's an elitist, right? It's like a populist elitism, almost of, that we're the ones who truly get it. It's going to be a kind of small self-selecting crew of people who are kind of truly brave and willing to kind of look through all of the lies and will see the truth. It's a fascinating kind of way to think about communities. That's the way you think about a political entity as well, which, something that isn't necessarily like sovereign anywhere, but that has adherence everywhere. And I think it's that those two dynamics kind of do go hand in hand, but the notion of an elect or kind of a select crew of people who have kind of chosen to embrace this path is something that unites them. And that also kind of points to something really fundamental here, which is that this gives people a sense of agency. This gives people a sense that they have choices to make in the world, even amid all of these systemic kind of systems of oppression that seem to order their lives, and that they have a place they can make a difference. And that should not be underestimated as something that really gives appeal to these far right movements at this particular time.
Do I understand this correctly too, that there's another paradox insofar as that it's both apocalyptic in the sense that we need to move into a sort of, like, I guess, another stage of human existence, and it's not as it's in reaction to a failure of sort of the material world on some level, but we're not going to fix that so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think about the like apocalyptic exit as almost like an escape hatch, right? Of recognizing that the world as it is untenable for so many people, which I do believe that is the case. For many decades, right, the kind of the discourse, and this has not just been kind of among conservatives, but kind of left, right, center, has largely been a there is no alternative, right? This is the way the world is. And we may have some sort of like small, like, little tweaks that we can make, some sort of kind of technocratic like maneuvers that will make things slightly less miserable for people, but that a different kind of social and political order is fundamentally outside of our capacity. And I think that there is something very debilitating about that message, and that the far right, for better or for much worse, has been the ones who've been articulating a different vision. Now, the vision that they're articulating, I would argue, is never going to lead to human flourishing. It's only going to lead to more suffering and misery, which is why the apocalypse is a very handy kind of mechanism. Right? Because it both expresses a sense of frustration with the world as it is, and a belief in some sort of alternative, but it removes the burden of having to actually articulate what that alternative might be and how it might actually allow us to live and not merely to die.
It's
sort of like the Republicans wanting to, repeal the Affordable Care Act on some level. I mean, I don't want to diminish it in that sense, but there is that quality of like, we just need to get rid of this. And then something will come back in and take care of everything. But let's, you write at one point that the last several decades themselves have generated a specific type of religious militancy. And I guess we see this in the context of it developing into an ISIS, let's say. But let's start to bring together these two sort of what appear at first glance a disparate and almost antithetical worlds, but are in fact on some level a reflection of each other or a causation in some respects. So tease that out for us. Like, what is it about the last several decades? A and B, what is the religious militancy mm-hmm. that has been generated is different, and that I would imagine applies not just to what we see in the context of ISIS, but also I got three stories today about January 6th involving some form of sort of like quasi Christian patriot organizations or something.
We can and should think about religious sensibilities operating outside of purely like spaces that we recognize immediately as religious, right? Like there is a religious aesthetics to QAnon, certainly, right? It depends on kind of similar structures of faith, belief, of electedness, of chosenness. There's all sorts of, layers of this, even within things that would not necessarily be explicitly recognized as religious. So we have to kind of, I think a little bit broadly also about like what that term is and what it is that we're invoking. We talk about things kind of, having a religious element to them. But, I think, let me see, how should we approach this question? One way of approaching this question is maybe to lean a little bit into what I don't think is helpful, right? I don't think it's helpful to kind of pathologize, these people who are part of these kind of extreme groups as either like nut jobs or wackadoos or terrorists. Like all of these terms get kind of thrown around. And they're not actually very helpful to understanding, why are these movements flourishing today? Like, what are the kind of structural forces that kind of produce them? Because we know from any number of studies that like people who join them are not like, but they don't have some sort of like a pathology. That's not actually the thing that we can lean into in order to explain them. It has to be something else. I really do think about this kind of going back to that question of agency, which I highlighted before, that people, I think, there's a few things. There's a question of agency. There's a question of community and belonging. And then, yes, there's a question about a kind of critique of the status quo. How is it that we are going to do those things? So on the one hand, right, you people do feel really demobilized. People, theorists like Wendy Brown talk about this as an effect of neoliberalism. It's this mode of politics that's made to almost make you feel small, to make you feel like the overarching systems are just too big to tackle. And, so we can like scream about them on Twitter, but we don't have much in the way of like real civic agency in order to address them. And I think that these types of movements thrive on that sense of disenchantment with the status quo and that sense of demobilization, and that there is kind of, that there aren't really pathways of civic agency. I think that these communities hold out community of a real and kind of robust sort, which is something that's in kind of short supply in many countries, particularly under kind of conditions of contemporary capital. And that, yes, that is frankly quite appealing to a lot of people. And not, again, not without reason, like the agency, the community, these are actually things that we want people to be able to have. But then it does become a problem when the, only people who are offering them up are those on the kind of the far right.
Well, there's two things I want to unpack there. I want to get to your definition of neoliberalism in a moment too, because that's also another word that we hear used quite a bit and sort of almost catch all. But speaking in terms of the pathologies, there is, and I'm just curious as to your sense of this, and maybe this doesn't constitute a pathology, but there is clinical research that suggests that we have you know, 25%, I think it was, Bob Altmaier up in University of Manitoba, this is years ago, but was doing work on right-wing authoritarianism, and over the course of a 20-30-year career had determined that there was about 25% of North Americans were right-wing authoritarians. This authoritarianism is there, and it's latent, and it's played into, and it needs to be activated. And so maybe it's these contexts that is being generated that creates an environment for that type of authoritarianism to sort of like kick into high gear, right? Is that the idea?
I think that's very close to it, because yes, it's right. We certainly know that there are people who have like more like authoritarian proclivities, but I think that people lean into those or can lean into them, particularly when they feel like the pathways for political change through traditional means are hollowed out or they're bankrupt, or they don't lead anywhere. So that sense of mass disenchantment, all of our politicians are all the same, nothing yet, right? That kind of talk always kind of piques my ears as something that kind of really can support an authoritarian kind of alternative, because it's at that moment of kind of total disenchantment with the status quo and with, again, all the traditional means of change within the kind of system as it is, that you open up those kind of possibilities for an authoritarian ruler, right? Someone like a Trump figure to kind of surge onto the stage and say, yes, I recognize all your woes, they're valid, and I am the only one who can fix them. The problem is that you've been trying to fix these things through democratic means, which is, again, strikingly similar to what the Islamic State kind of says in terms of why it rejects democracy as a political model. I mean, there's a lot of writing. You don't think about ISIS as being political theorists, but there's a lot of political writing they have about kind of the failures of democracy as a political model that, you know, many of them kind of lean into this this kind of impossibility of affecting real change through democratic means, in addition to kind of critiques of democracy as theoretically kind of coming from a particular view of divine sovereignty.
Okay, now, and I want you to expand on your concept of neoliberalism, because I think you know, to some extent we discuss it around here in the context of a fealty to the market and maybe going back to like the Mont Pelerin crew, who it's a fealty to the market, but also with like maybe a thumb on the scale if you have control of government.
Absolutely.
But talk about the broader implications that it creates for a democratic society that go beyond it as an economic prescription.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important, because yes, this is not just a kind of question of an economic model, but the right, if we kind of we think about economic models, also have these kind of massive political and social effects as well. So, you know, neoliberalism is kind of sometimes thought about as like a small government approach, right? With this idea of kind of a laissez-faire, the government kind of backing away from intervention in the markets, that kind of along the lines of that kind of, you know, Keynesian New Deal era, kind of American Depression kind of period, where there was this consensus that the government had to play a role in kind of managing the economy, in particular, you know, adopting things like counter-cyclic spending, for instance, to try to kind of soften the blows of different financial crises. So neoliberalism emerges as, you know, as this kind of critique of that kind of New Deal or kind of Keynesian interventionism of the state and the economy. But it's not really a small government project at the end of the day. It's much more accurate to think about neoliberalism as a project of state capture and redeployment, where corporate lobbyists are like literally writing the bills that are then adopted by the Congress, for instance, with regard to regulation. That's not the government getting out of the way of business. That is literally business gaining the upper hand over government. So I like to think about neoliberalism as that kind of practice of state capture, where government's powers are deployed in the service of the market and its beneficiaries, kind of over above the kind of public good. And this is why also neoliberalism doesn't come with like, there's certainly no shrinking of the state in terms of policing or mass incarceration or military, right? All of those kind of mechanisms of state violence that are required to uphold the kind of status quo, those things get all the funding in the world under neoliberalism. But like, of course, like education or, you know, addiction treatment programs or, God forbid, federally funded daycare, right? These things are never going to, these things are supposed to be solved by the market. So in terms of the kind of type of politics that this advances, it's right. I mean, it really does give us people like Donald Trump, this notion that businessmen are the people who are best equipped to run the country, that things should be run like a business, that schools should be run like a business, that right, all of our public services will be better accommodated if we only subject them to market forces. And what that means is that politics is not supposed to be a space where we collectively come together and decide how we want things to be and solve problems, right? It means that we're supposed to give up all of these, you know, kind of public interventions that a democracy would normally have to the market and whoever that benefits. And we know that that benefits really people who already have a lot of resources and advantage. This is why people talk about neoliberalism as something that has an anti-democratic underpinning to it, because the purpose, if of taking all of these things outside of the realm of public deliberation and putting them into the hands of the market, really means putting them beyond the capacity of like a public to to change things in a way that might be better.
Right. I mean, it's both purpose and process, right? I mean, they referred to George W. Bush as the CEO president, and that's a problem, both in terms of like who the CEO is working for, which tends to be the board of directors and himself. But it's also a problem because CEOs are not elected. They're chosen, and they're not, I mean, they're if they were elected, then the workers theoretically would all vote on who they want to run. Maybe they wouldn't even choose a CEO per se, but that is, so it's both the process and the sort of the material outcome from that, from once that process is installed.
Yeah, no, I think that that's exactly right. And just, I mean, I said, this is pervasive, again, like left, right, center. Anytime we hear people talking about how X public good should be run like a business, or this person is uniquely qualified to run for public office because they ran a company, right? These are all kind of legacies of this neoliberal turn and the kind of, you know, fetishization of like basically business principles and their application to every realm.
And so, okay, so how does then, when we see something like ISIS, at one point you call it a form of colonial blowback from neoliberalism.
My view of neoliberalism, right? Like, I'm trained as a historian, particularly as like a historian of the Middle East. And so as I'm kind of reading through a lot of these sources and seeing about things that are happening in the States or in other Western countries over the last few years, it all feels a little bit like eerily familiar to me, because what it is, it's this process of state capture by capital, where the state is made to serve the ends of capital, and to suppress the kind of popular resentment that kind of comes from that. And that's exactly the kind of the distribution of kind of state, market, and violence that you see in colonies and kind of the classic colonial situations, where the state is there to serve the ends of kind of private capital, who is there to exploit people and to prevent the people essentially from rising up and overthrowing the system. And so we can, rather than always thinking about our political models as emerging in the West and then kind of getting disseminated and spreading to the rest of the world, I tend to think about the colonies as being this key site of emergence for different political forms. And yeah, neoliberalism, you know, one way of thinking about it, I'm not saying this is the only way, but this is the way that I tend to think about it, is as this kind of form of colonial blowback, wherein those conditions that have like long prevailed in the kind of colonized world are suddenly being felt right back home. We're like, really, who's in charge of this place anyway? Like, right? Like, our government is theoretically sovereign, but yet we can't figure out how to do the most basic thing, which is tax our most major corporations. Like, it really does throw into kind of sharp relief the question as to who is really like running the ship here.
Is it blowback from colonialism, or is it sort of just sort of on some level I don't want to say self-imposed, but it's simply imposed. It's a domestic colonialism.
It's a domestic application of a series of conditions, which I think have long prevailed in the colonial world and even in the post-colonial world. And the reason that you, I think, have, that it, like, again, the, the overlaps between, you know, the Islamic State and the American far right, et cetera. These things are not exact. And I've kind of written about the distinctions here, you know, at length. But I do think that one thing that's interesting by studying these kind of militant movements in the Middle East or kind of across the global South more broadly is that they're frankly at a more advanced stage of state fragmentation than we are. Right. Where the states in these places have not functioned as a vehicle for the public good for decades, if not centuries. And this type of militancy, I think, is a direct result of that kind of state fragmentation, the inability to govern, the inability, right? People have to have like some sort of buy-in, some sort of faith in the system. And that faith doesn't just come from people repeating kind of ad nauseum that democracy is awesome. It comes because they see some sort of material benefits of that. And if you get to a point where people can no longer see the material benefits of that, then you really do have this kind of possibility for a kind of a crisis of governance and a possibility of fragmentation.
I mean, so it's conceivable that we are evolving on some level or just...
we might be catching up.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to right, and I mean, and let's talk about that because you also make the argument that liberalism, broadly speaking, and I think that we've been talking about this at least maybe sort of around the edges a little bit, is that liberalism has failed to control violence, which was, you know, part of the certainly the purpose of it, right? I mean, you can't have all of these operations of modern society as liberalism was purportedly a system to provide if you have ongoing violence, because there must, and talk about the different ways that it's failed, both in terms of, you know, individual violence and state violence.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a few different ways of even kind of opening up to this question. But on the one hand, that, right, that there's, right, in theory, under liberalism, right, there, right, we've all kind of traded our right for private violence, right? So, Sam, if you come and rob my house, I'm not going to, like, chase you down. I'm going to call the police, right? That's, I'm abandoning my right to private violence, and I'm giving it over to some sort of sovereign, some sort of state authority that's supposed to kind of enforce the law on my behalf. And this is at least the theory.
And the same thing with, like, we have a contract and you didn't fulfill it, instead of me coming over there and, you know, I don't know, with a bat and saying, you know, give me my cow or whatever it is, I go to court.
Yes, but my daughter takes Taekwondo, so you better watch out if you try that.
But I did too.
But yes, no, that's precisely the idea. Now, we already see the breakdown of that system for quite a long time here, right? One place you can look at it is the kind of privatization of violence in terms of, like, the American military, for instance, right? We just had this kind of disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, but it's, like, often not noted that for many years there have been way more private contractors in Afghanistan than there have been regular servicemen. And that has been the case in Iraq as well. And really, you know, going back to the, you know, mid-1990s and the rise of Blackwater, it's been a kind of privatization bonanza of what else, but actually, like, state violence. So that you, and that's important because it means that we have less accountability. We have less insight, oversight, kind of in control really over the violence that's, you know, being inflicted, right? Americans have, this has kind of been a feature of the war on terror that was so notable, is that people are just so in the dark, about what was happening, right? 80 plus countries that we've been, you know, conducting, you know, global war on terror operations in, like, I'm guessing people maybe name a fraction of them, if any at all, right? That level of kind of opacity into the way that state violence is occurring is kind of part of this, like, loss of public control over this thing. And of course, right, we could talk also about the ways in which that blowback occurs through the militarization of police forces and kind of, you know, the kind of, you know, change in policing, you know, so on and so forth. So all of that violence is real and I think it does signal kind of a crisis for liberalism in terms of we don't really have the thing that we're supposed to have, which is democratic control over violence. And but there's another piece of that as well, right? That stuff is kind of the spectacular violence, the news making violence. We can also think about, you know, what people like Rob Nixon call slow violence, which is just like the everyday grinding violence of essentially of like the market that the state is complicit in. So when you have people kind of, you know, who live in right next to sites of kind of toxic waste that has kind of been dumped on, right, and are kind of dying of cancer or other diseases, right? This is a form of violence as well. But it's, again, not the kind of same headline grabbing. When you have people who are, you know, suffering heat stroke in their kind of, because they have inadequate housing in, you know, the American Southwest, for instance, as we saw kind of over the last summer, this is also a form of violence. And in theory, we don't want this type, we don't want people in a democracy to be subjected to this type of violence either, which is often that, yeah, the violence really of market forces that the state is complicit in.
And where does like the idea that we have these massive explosion of gun sales in a time where ostensibly there doesn't seem to be any call for it, right? I mean, it's almost just sort of like there's this sort of increase in potential violence, right? Yeah. I mean, every gun and bullet bought is, you know, just sitting there, you know, on the desk, as it were, waiting for Act Three.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the, I kind of written about this for Mother Jones a while back about the kind of ways in which American gun culture has really evolved and not for the best in the kind of shadows of the war on terror, the sense of being under siege, even when kind of statistical evidence will like point that like actually we're like safer than we've probably ever been, right? That we don't see that message being communicated, you know, in gun sales and or in their marketing. And, you know, I think that it's, again, I could say a lot of things about this, but one thing that I kind of always come back to is that the role of violence in our society is changing. I think that violence has become really, for the right, the premier form of civic participation. And this is part of the kind of authoritarianism. Right. Like, we don't want you to govern, but we do want you to harm. And the kind of the, you know, a lot of things have been kind of refashioned with violence at the core. And things like being a gun owner, how that is so integral to people's identities. Right. In a way that I do think is relatively novel, even within, you know, say like my lifetime. Like, I mean, I grew up in South Dakota in like an absolute gun owning home, but the gun culture I grew up in was like literally nothing like the thing that exists today.
So where does this go? I mean, are we, you doff your cap, maybe that's the wrong way of saying it, to Francis Fukuyama and the idea of the end of history on some level. But what where does this trajectory take us? Or how much time do we have?
I always say that, you know, historians have very fuzzy crystal balls, right. But there are a bunch of different responses that are, you know, that are going to be required. And, you know, I should say I am not a political strategist by training, but it does seem to me that we are experiencing a crisis of governance, where people do not believe in the kind of faith of, they have no faith in the kind of government to deliver anything that is anything good for them. And that kind of leads us to this like danger zone in terms of state fragmentation. On the one hand, one thing we have to do is actually govern at all levels. And I think using far more means that are at people's disposal than the ones that kind of Democrats have been willing to use thus far. You know, I know you've talked on the show before about kind of the Biden mansion show off, and that, you know, Biden seems kind of just like constitutionally unable to do, I think, what is required in this moment, because this isn't going to get better. Like this isn't going to get better just kind of by like leaning into this notion that, oh, well, we're right and they're wrong. The facts will kind of, you know, prove X, Y, or Z.
Is there a place in the world? I mean, if what we see with ISIS is in some ways a, you know, sort of a reflection of what we're experiencing in terms of neoliberalism around the world on some level. Is there a place that's doing it well? I mean, is there a place where the people are, you know, government is providing for us, that we can have faith in the functioning of our government? And you know, there's always going to be disaffected people, but there's not enough to create an instability with our society.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think, listen, we could certainly point to like certain European countries as doing a better job with this. You know, you have places like Denmark that managed to vaccinate, say, just take that as your index, 90% of their population without any sort of mandates. What that displays is a very high level of kind of buy-in about the kind of force of government as a source of good, right? Kind of, it's completely antithetical to the Ronald Reagan kind of, you know, view of I'm from the government and I'm here to help as being the kind of scariest thing that one can hear. But right, even so, a lot of that comes, you know, I don't want to glorify any of these kind of places because, right, there's a lot of like nativism that kind of comes with this. It's not like there's a kind of a perfect place that we can point to and say, they've got it right. But I think that we can, you know, point to a kind of constellation of features, you know, that we would want to see prevail within the United States that would give, you know, an agenda that really is, you know, built around serving the public good, as opposed to a kind of very small, you know, class of private interests, right? A government structure that reflects that, right? Like a massive reform of kind of campaign finance and election laws, voting rights laws, in order to make sure that the actual will of the people on all of, you know, on really points up and down the board is pretty clear. Even like these, like I always crack up, there's like the Fox News polls about like how popular, right? Essentially like the left agenda is. It's like, yes, we do want action on climate and universal healthcare. When you break these things down as a policy issues, they're actually very, very, very popular. And then we have to figure out then how is it that we can actually have a government that reflects the kind of will of the people. And I think the kind of longstanding approach, particularly from liberals, has been the assumption that the people are dumb, the people don't know what they want, and that if we can just have some sort of like technocratic or elite management that goes over their head, then that will be better for them. And I think that is a politics of failure that has led us precisely to where we are, and that we kind of, you know, back to the end of history sort of stuff, we need to reject the fact that this is how history ends, and we need to be putting forward some real alternatives.
Suzanne Schneider, Deputy Director, Core Faculty at the Brooklyn Institute, author of The Apocalypse and the End of History, Modern Jihad and the Crisis of Liberalism. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half, and joining us for the first time, 2022. Naomi Konst will be here. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And also a reminder that if you want access to the fun half but cannot afford to do so, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Kyle reminds me that we have over 1,300 folks who over the years have needed our help in terms of membership. So when you become a member, if you are in a situation where you can afford to do so, you are helping those folks out too. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Naomi, there you are. I had
down here.
Yeah, you know, I had it on. I had my thing on a different view because Matt is.
You were just looking at yourself.
He had it on vanity mode.
Look. No, I actually had it. I just had the letters. I just had a big display that said Matt Leck on it. Oh. I didn't see anybody. How are you? What's going on?
I got to say, I'm really happy that Queer Eye for the Straight Guy came to your house. Emma and I had been working really hard for the makeover, and it happened. So wait for that show to come out, guys.
There you go.
That'd be a great, funny episode watching Sam squirm.
Well, thank you. Where did you get that 12-foot microphone?
It's just my table's a little higher today. This is the magic, guys. This is how it works. See, you guys keep it a secret. I show all the behind the scenes stuff. What? It's just a little closer.
It's right here. It looks. What's happening? Happy New Year.
You're like a little further. I could be like, Happy New Year. Happy 2022. What's happening? Today we're doing, we have a great interview with Harvey K to start off the new year, because Harvey and I have been like texting our fear for what's coming in 2022. And we wanted to start off by talking to folks about, we have been here before. Spoiler, not great. Maybe we should get ready and really let it sink in. Just how bad it could get.
Smedley Butler come up in that conversation?
No, it didn't, but maybe it will today.
Wasn't he approached for the coup? Wasn't Smedley Butler approached for the coup at one point against FDR?
The business plot that the Bush family patriarchs were involved in. They said, hey, help us coup FDR. And he said, I'm not going to do that.
I'm not doing that, yeah. Interesting. Sorry. I'll ask him. That's good.
I'm so psyched you're here today, because there's a story about the, I don't know that I have celebrated a failure of something more, but that would be the bipartisan redistricting commission in New York failing. I'm curious as to where you think New York State's going to go, because this is going to have implications in terms of maybe control of the Congress. We will talk about that in the fun half. But before we do, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
So hopefully this weekend we'll be recording for Literary Hangover, our John Milton episode on Areopagitica, talking about free speech except for the papists. And also Left Reckoning will be back. Not a full show tomorrow night, but David and I will be doing a stream at the normal time, 8 o'clock Eastern. So Left Reckoning, check that out, folks.
What did I just, are we streaming okay? I just got a message that the app is not working. Maybe we should check on that. All right. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back. We're going to head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boys, back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boys, back. And the alpha males are back, back, back. Back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday! My birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.